This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 398 was produced on October 19th, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. Best-selling author Lynn Alden returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll talk about her new book, Broken Money, before moving on to discuss the end of the peace dividend, energy scarcity, and much more. I've also invited our friend Dr. Anas Alhaji to make a brief cameo appearance in the crude oil update of our post-game segment after the feature interview with Lynn Alden, when Anas will update us to the risks to the oil market in the event of escalation of the Israel-Gaza conflict.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, October 18th, 2023. The S&P 500 December futures were down 152 basis points, closing at 43.42. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in our post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index up 79 basis points, closing to 106.56. U.S. dollar index up 79 basis points to 106.56. The dollar continues to trade along multi-month highs. The December crude oil contract up 634 basis points to 87.27. We'll take a look at that chart in the post-game, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The December RBOB gasoline up 639 basis points to 233. Prices retracing some of the breakdown from September. The December gold contract up 429 basis points to 1968. An extraordinary rebound from the September sell-off, getting the prices back towards the summer highs. Copper down 55 basis points to 359, continues to consolidate along the 52-week lows. And uranium up 232 basis points to 7060, turning higher after several weeks of consolidation. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 35 basis points, closing at 491. A material breakout in yields now eyeing the 5% level. The key news to watch next week is the global flash manufacturing and services PMIs, the Bank of Canada and the ECB monetary policy statements, the core PCE index, the consumer sentiment, and we continue into the heart of earnings season. This week's feature interview guest is best-selling author Lynn Alden. Eric, why did we invite Lynn back on as a guest this week?
Patrick, Lynn has been a listener favorite, but more importantly, I really think the topic of her book, Broken Money, is just incredibly timely. We do have a broken financial system. It's going to morph into a digital financial system. And guess what? The process for getting us from here to there is anything but organized and under control. So it's a really important topic, and I'm looking forward to this interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Lynn Alden is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Strategy and best-selling author of Broken Money. Lynn, it's great to have you back. You've written a terrific book. It bears a lot in similar to my book with one very subtle distinction, which is nobody read my book and you're not only on the best-selling list, but you're at the top of it. Number one bestseller and an absolutely fabulous book. I want to add my personal endorsement to it. I don't mind saying that when I wrote my book, I just wanted to get what was on my mind about my predictions about Bitcoin and central bank digital currencies off my chest. In your case, you did a much more comprehensive job. You did the job on this book that I probably should have done on mine. So congratulations for all of the well-deserved praise that it's received. I want to start, though, with why you did this. You wrote a book called Broken Money. Obviously, you think the money system is broken. You did this at a time that the world is contemplating what digital currency means, both private label and central bank issued digital currency. What's the backstory? Why was this the time to write a book about the money system being broken?
Yeah. So first of all, thank you for having me on. Always happy to be here, and I appreciate your support of the book. That certainly means a lot. One of the advice I give people is don't write a book unless you feel like you have to, because for people that work in our kind of industry, it's going to be a massive time sink. It's going to take a lot of time. It's not a good ROI if you're thinking just of, you know, the money. It's really about, you have ideas in your head that you just feel like are best in book form, and it's calling to you at the moment. And so I had written a lot of content over the past 5+ years on a multiple of subjects based around money, energy, the structure of markets, you know, Bitcoin, stablecoins, CBDCs, inflation, that whole gamut. And I felt that there were some frameworks that were kind of important enough that a whole book would be useful for them, in the sense that you can walk the reader through from first principles, how do we get here, what's going on. And I felt like there's just not a lot of focus on how technology changes how we use money, both in history and the present, and some of the underlying structures for how the system works. So I generally find that when I get questions from people, you know, they read one of my long form articles, but they don't necessarily read, like, you know, the past 5 long form articles. And sometimes there's ones that feed right into another one and ones that don't. So I figured putting them in a book form is kind of like basically guiding the reader through this more chronological order of things. And I felt that money's a complex enough subject that's also poorly understood. And it's really one of those that I think deserves a full book treatment.
Let's talk about broken money and why it's broken. Are we just talking about indebtedness, you know, national debt, that kind of thing? Or are we talking about the actual monetary system, which is broken? And if so, how is it broken?
I consider them similar questions, because the type of money enables what type of debt can build on it and how long that type of debt can last. But debt's not the only problem. The way I would describe it is that over time, technology has allowed us to move money more efficiently. But the problem is that there's been a bigger and bigger disconnect between transaction speeds and settlement speeds. And so, for example, you know, we can kind of separate things in a few key eras. Prior to the invention and the adoption of the telegraph, information and matter moved roughly at the same speed. And so you couldn't really transmit complex information any faster than a human could go on horse or ship. Whereas once we had the telegraph, which, you know, was invented in the 1830s, but it wasn't really adopted over long distances until like the 1860s. That's also when the cross Atlantic one was constructed. And so you had basically the whole Western world connected. And then over time, the following decades, the whole world. And that gave us the ability to send long distance information, large amounts of it, at roughly the speed of light. While at the time you had a gold standard, you had, you know, physical money, and that could not settle anywhere near that speed. And so we relied on ever increasing amounts of centralization and abstraction to do that. And it's obviously been very efficient in some ways, but it's also opened up a bunch of problems. I would kind of describe it as like a local maximum, where we've achieved enough good things, but we also have a number of costs associated with it. And I think the one big one I point to is that when you look around the world, there's over 160 different currencies out there. And if you're not in the top few of them, your money most likely loses value very quickly. And your money has virtually no acceptance outside of your little currency bubble. And you have trouble investing in capital assets in your little currency bubble unless you're, you know, wealthy enough to be able to go offshore. And so basically there's billions of people just kind of trapped with worse money than we have in the fully developed world. But of course, even in the developed world, we have other types of problems, basically, you know, large amounts of debt, more subtle effects from broken money. And so I wanted to kind of focus on, when you kind of step out and zoom in on the whole thing, how kind of duct tape-like our current monetary system is, just in large part based on technological limitations it's had.
Duct tape-like, that is a fantastic description of or pertaining to Bondo and bailing wire, which is the way it feels like our financial system is some days. Then you get, in 2008, some guy or gal going under the pseudonym of Satoshi invents some really interesting technology, but it wasn't invented from the standpoint of trying to fix the system. It was actually invented from the standpoint of competing with the system. How do you interpret the advent of Bitcoin and therefore the advent of double spend proof digital cash and distributed ledger into this whole equation?
Yeah, so I think what a lot of people don't know about the space is that there was a ton of work before Bitcoin by a number of software people, cryptographers, about how to make this work. So, for example, David Chaum, back in like the early 80s, published a paper on how mutually suspicious groups can basically operate a shared database or ledger together. It was kind of like proto-Bitcoin in a way. And he eventually went on to you know, do blind signatures and eCash and just various kind of cryptography techniques to move value. They didn't really achieve network effects, and they had some centralization issues. Then throughout the 90s, you had developments in proof of work, basically the idea of trying to create digital scarcity, like making something that is a puzzle that's hard to solve but easy to verify once it's solved, kind of like a Rubik's Cube, for example. It's a little challenging to get all the colors lined up, but anyone who, even if they don't know how to solve a Rubik's Cube, can look at a solved one and say, okay, that one's solved. So there were a bunch of puzzles like that that were figured out, but the problem was that they were still centralized for the most part. And then basically Satoshi, the team, the person, whoever it was, put a number of these existing pieces together. Also, by that time, better and better cryptographic techniques were developed. Internet bandwidth had improved enough that the amount of data made more sense, the amount of storage and processing. Basically, a number of things just increasingly came together to make something like this more possible. And essentially, what he created was peer-to-peer money, or another way of thinking of it is a decentralized ledger, a decentralized database that can hold, you know, some arbitrary information, but it's primarily meant to you know, basically move around entries on this ledger. It's basically a gigantic global decentralized Excel spreadsheet. It's kind of when you get down to it. And that is just now an open competition. And of course, that spawned all sorts of other things. That spawned, you know, trying to create more programmable ones or trying to put other assets and to kind of explore if there's anything other than money that this particular method could be useful for. And, you know, we could talk more about some of the details, but I think basically that is, you know, when you look at the whole space, there's tons of fraud and speculation and scams. And that makes sense anytime a gatekeeper is drawn down, right? So if it gets easier for people to publish books and they go around publishers, that's a good thing in a way, but you're also going to get a long tail of really bad books coming to market. Same thing if anyone can make their own TV show, anyone can make their own radio show, which is, you know, what we're doing here. There's going to be high quality ones coming to market that might not have otherwise gotten on major media, but at the same time, there's going to be a long tail of low quality ones. And essentially what we're seeing now is the gatekeepers down money and financial assets. And so there's interesting things out there, but that's kind of blinded by the noise of how much scams that this also allows.
So we start with a very broken financial system. I think you and I agree the financial system was quite broken. Then you get the advent of digital money, which was not designed by the people in charge of the broken financial system. Then you have the people who are in charge of the broken financial system to start to look at it and realize, wait a minute, this is a serious threat. Maybe we need to have our own digital money system. You get to CBDCs. But the people who feel that way aren't really sure what Bitcoin is and how it works. So when they try to invent their first CBDCs, they're not really sure what they're doing, at least in the beginning. And now I think you've got a global competition for governments to get their heads around what this technology is. And unfortunately, I don't think they're intending to use it in the ways Satoshi intended. It seems to me that we still have a coming reckoning of the CBDCs, where we have all the governments of the world try to reapply the technology invented by Satoshi and the Bitcoiners in an opposite direction, using it for the purpose of creating more oversight and control over the financial system, not less. And when that happens, I think there's going to be a fight between those who originally saw digital currency as a freedom of money as opposed to a less freedom of money kind of development. Where is this all headed, and how do you see it playing out?
So I think you described the situation well, which is basically there's a big fork in the road and very kind of divergent opinions. Basically, there's, for lack of a better word, open source money that is basically people can build upon it. It's scarce. It's, you know, it's very costly to try to censor it. And then you have central bank digital currencies. And basically, it's the fork in the road is that over the past, call it century and a half or even more, most problems in money have been solved by greater and greater centralization and abstraction, which of course comes with a big cost of privacy, inflation, control, all that kind of stuff. And central bank digital currencies basically continue that trend. They get even more centralized, even more surveillable, and even more kind of hyper-efficient in a way. And the other path says that, you know, with this new technology, there's finally a way to have some of those efficiencies without ever-increasing centralization and abstraction, and that you can actually have more decentralization, but then also a large portion of that efficiency. If you can build systems that are robust enough and that have the right incentives to make it very hard for people to deal with. And I think the challenge is that governments, you know, when you're looking outside of authoritarian governments or sometimes even within them, but basically, especially in anything resembling a democracy, government's not really a monolith. There's multiple different parties involved. And so, for example, in the US government, there's a number, you know, that the acting Speaker of the House is hosting the Bitcoin white paper on Congress's website. There's been a number of pro-Bitcoin senators, representatives, presidential candidates. The main opposition in Canada is very much in favor of Bitcoin. There's a number of countries around the world that all have different opinions on it. And it's in one country, it's legal tender, granted a small country. And so there's basically this mix out there. And there's even some, you know, countries like Dubai or Singapore kind of set themselves up as little hubs where that are more kind of friendly to this sort of financial innovation, mainly because they want to attract any sort of companies that want to go there that might be repelled from more friction-filled jurisdictions. I think a key thing to think about this is I think there's really two levels that are operating on. It's besides central bank digital currencies. So there's central bank digital currencies. Then there's something like Bitcoin, which optimizes to be as decentralized as possible. And then there's also, I think, what does not get enough like coverage in macro circles, because I think it's big enough to have eventual macro implications, is things like stable coins, which allow better jurisdictions to pierce into weaker jurisdictions and offer them assets in a way that's hard for the governments of those weaker jurisdictions to stop. And what I mean by that is, you know, something like a stablecoin is centralized, but the central hub can be in any jurisdiction. You can put it in the United States, you can put it in Switzerland, you can put it in, you know, Dubai, whatever country you're thinking. And then they can offer these basically redeemable assets. Maybe it's dollars, maybe it's gold, right? These things already exist. Maybe it's T-bills. Those are starting to come out now. And so anyone in, say, Nigeria or Argentina or Turkey, for example, they have a ton of different ways to be able to access those assets in a way that they didn't really have access to these assets before. It was much harder to get things. If we think of the 160 different currency bubbles out there, they all have financial firewalls around themselves, right? So if you want to bring capital in or out of those countries, there's historically two main ways to do it. Either, you know, bank transfers, which are heavily government controlled, and there is ports of entry. Right? But of course, you can only bring so much cash or gold through an airport, and they have pretty tight control over their financial borders. And that is, you know, obviously they want to keep out money laundering, they want to keep out all sorts of illicit behavior. But a big consequence of that is they also keep people locked in financially. So if you're stuck in a jurisdiction with 20% annual currency growth, weak capital markets, you know, if you're very wealthy, you might be able to get an offshore account. But if you're middle class or lower, you're probably going to have a lot more trouble with that. And that even if you are wealthy, they can block you from basically getting your money out. And what some of these technologies do, you know, Bitcoin does it, but also with something like a stablecoin, you can put the central hub in any better jurisdiction. And then now basically the gates are down on these 160 different currency bubbles. So for example, you can't bring much cash or gold through an airport, but you can memorize 12 words as your Bitcoin private key, essentially. And you can go in there with an unlimited amount of money or go out of there with a limited amount of money. If I want to hire a Nigerian graphic designer, you know, they can send me a string of characters in an email and I can pay them. They can show me a QR code over a camera and I could pay them. So whether it's remittances, whether it's peer-to-peer financial market transactions, whether it's even just bringing physically with you through ports of entry, that all those 160 firewalls around countries are basically a lot more porous now, not just with Bitcoin, but also with these other ones. And I think that has long-term ramifications for a lot of these countries being able to retain their own, you know, little like siloed ecosystems financially.
Let's talk a little bit more about stablecoins and their relationship with central bank digital currencies. You've got an entire chapter 27 in the book about that. I think this is most interesting because clearly there's a desire on the part of actors in the mainstream financial system to consider more adoption of digital currency. But when you look at the official issuers of fiat currency, the governments, well, their product is the central bank digital currencies. And so far, people are saying, I could take the official government-labeled digital currency and assume the government actually knows what they're doing when it comes to building a digital currency. Or I could put my money in this thing called a stablecoin, which is like a private actor creating a digital currency that just parallels an existing fiat currency, such as the U.S. dollar. And even though it's not official from the official issuer of the U.S. dollar, I think that might be better because I trust the guy that made the stablecoin more than I trust the U.S. government to know about digital currency. But wait a minute, I trust the guy with the stablecoin to know more about it, but I don't necessarily trust them not to use that knowledge against me. And that's what's happened is we've had some stablecoin operators that were more savvy than the U.S. government about understanding digital currency and in a better position than the CBDC issuers to come up with something that was viable. But they didn't necessarily have the investors' goals in mind, and some of them stole the money. So what do we do with this environment? It seems like we're really in the wild west of digital currency adoption, and nobody's really sure where it's headed.
Yeah, I think those are great questions. I think that's normal for the early phase of this industry. I think on one hand, when we talk about stablecoins, I think it's important to separate algorithmic stablecoins from collateralized stablecoins. So algorithmic stablecoins are basically trying to back themselves with a kind of fluctuating crypto made out of thin air. And a collateralized stablecoin, if they're on the up and up, they are, you know, they're being wired money. They're storing that in some sort of safe collateral. They're issuing tokens that are then redeemable for dollars on demand by large entities. And of course, any smaller entities that can't redeem a bit can still trade, you know, with larger entities that can. So you basically create this token that is backed by supposedly full reserves. And, you know, there are various attestations or audits or proof of reserves that can happen. There's different types of transparency that can happen. Like you can list all your CUSIPs. You know, there's various ways to increasingly solidify those types of assets and make them more reputable. You know, what jurisdiction they're in, who's their custodian, which firms have audited or attested that they have the collateral, right? So I think that over time, these things can become more serious, and they've already kind of trended towards that direction. Some of them have withstood large bank runs, but, you know, make no mistake, they are centralized. They're basically, you know, the ones that are offshore are basically digital euro dollars. The ones that are onshore are, you know, onshore dollars that have a global reach. Then, like I said, there's also ones that are not even dollar-based. Like you can have a gold-backed stablecoin. There are a number of those that exist. They're not nearly as big, but they're out there. Basically, you can have like a gold token that is redeemable in size for Swiss gold, for example. And so basically what these do is these assets are now available globally, and the jurisdiction from which it operates from or whose assets it holds has power over it. So for example, if someone uses stablecoins for criminal activity that is enough to be recognized, the central issuer can freeze those assets. And they can use various surveillance techniques to try to do that. They can try to block access to certain countries. That's the either upside or downside of those centralized assets, depending on how you look at them, is that, for example, Argentina can't do anything about the fact that stablecoins exist, but the United States could, is kind of the main point. Or, for example, if it's a Swiss entity with gold, you know, Turkey can't do anything about the fact that that exists, but Switzerland can, right? So it really comes down to whether or not those high power jurisdictions would like the fact that these things can operate in their countries and provide access to their assets in a global way. So when we talk about things like, for example, BRICS countries trying to de-dollarize, when you actually have a boots on the ground in those countries, the people in those countries generally are not currently on track for de-dollarization. So their presidents might be, their congresses might be, but when you go down to the public level, there's still a lot of network effect around the dollar and things like that. And so they're happy to have things like physical dollars if they can, or stable coins if they're a more tech-savvy type of place. And it's obviously harder to get dollars. And so basically, this is just the gates are down on 160 different, you know, kind of currency bubbles here. And it really kind of comes down to the pleasure of some of these stronger jurisdictions if they want to allow that. Now, with Bitcoin's different because There's no central entity that can censor it unless they manage to achieve and maintain over half of the network hash rate. And it's kind of shown remarkable resilience in the sense that, you know, in 2021, for example, the majority of the hash rate was in China. China banned it. And so, you know, they had quote unquote banned it a number of times, but it never really stuck. But this time they were more serious about it. And so you saw about half of the network come offline. And if you had told, for example, Amazon or Microsoft, you have to move your servers internationally and you have to shut them off next week, you can imagine the disruption and the uptime problems that they would have for basically the next year or more. Whereas with Bitcoin, when half the network went offline, all it did was slow down by little under half. So the average block time was, you know, about 18 minutes instead of like 10 minutes. And that lasted about a week or two until the automatic difficulty adjustment kicked in and then it went back to normal speed. So it operated with 100% uptime as its miners were basically, you know, shut down and then dispersed globally, almost like a swarm kind of reforming itself in a different set of jurisdictions. So there's different levels of decentralization here. But I think the main thing it comes down to is the fact that even if you, you know, there's something like Bitcoin is an interesting challenge even to the stronger jurisdictions, whereas something like stablecoins or other, you know, tokenized assets like gold or T-bills are a challenge to virtually any of the weaker jurisdictions and are basically an advantage for some of the stronger jurisdictions.
Lynn, you finished your book with three entire chapters dedicated to what I think is the most important topic of our times, really, which is financial technology and its implications on human rights. And I think this is a very underappreciated subject. Why did you put so much attention in this? And give us a quick summary of your views.
When I cover these markets, I do it both from an investor standpoint, right? So if an investor sees 160 currency gates down, that's an interesting opportunity, I would say. Basically, it's kind of like how technology has disrupted media, it's disrupted publishing. Now it can increasingly disrupt finance. So there's an investor standpoint there. But then there's also, you know, I think a bigger story about what that means for power structures, what that means for human rights in general, what that means for options that are available for people. For people that follow my work for a while, they probably know that every year I travel back and forth between the United States and Egypt. My husband's originally from Cairo. And so a lot of our family is in Egypt. That's our second home. And so each year I experience both a developed country and a developing country. So I see what happens to people when they have 20% money supply growth every year like clockwork. What happens when they get capital controls? What happens when they don't have the depth of capital markets available to them to invest in? And what do they end up doing? Like, I know doctors that hold physical cash dollars as savings, because that's what they've looked around and decided was some of the best things to hold, you know, earning no interest, susceptible to theft, and of course, very hard to get in jurisdictions like that. And there's any number of those jurisdictions. And then we see, for example, increasing amounts of kind of big data surveillance, increasing, you know, basically it's kind of a race between top-down surveillance and control methods. Including, for example, China is now a leading exporter of surveillance equipment and software to countries around the world. And at the same time, you have some of these bottom-up technologies, you know, kind of starting with encryption. And going from there, you can encrypt information, you can encrypt value, which is a type of information. And these are basically defenses that people have against ever-increasing ways to kind of surveil people, control people, lock them in. And whenever people hear that, it can kind of sound conspiracy-like, but we just have to remember that, again, there are, you know, nearly 200 countries out there. A very large percentage of them are authoritarian, semi-authoritarian, have all sorts of capital controls, have all sorts of existing structures. And a lot of these things just make those even more thorough, which is why I think trying to make kind of robust technologies for them to kind of have options to push back, kind of like how I think it's useful for the internet and information to spread into these places. I also think it's useful for there to be more competition for global assets. So people that are in a jurisdiction should not just have access to their local assets, which, you know, could be kind of bad across the board in many cases. They should have ways to build savings and investments, or even have more portable capital that they could bring with them. and basically just have more access to the best assets of the world.
Listeners, again, the book is Broken Money. There's a link in your Research Roundup email to find the Amazon listing for the page. In addition to the book, Lynn has also prepared a slide deck to accompany this week's interview. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email as well. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Click the red button that says looking for the downloads. Lynn, you've got the end of the peace dividend on page one. It seems rather timely this week. We have escalations in the conflict with Ukraine and Russia. And of course, we also have the eruption of this major conflict between Israel and Hamas. What's on your mind as you put the end of the peace dividend on this slide, and how does it pertain to markets?
So I think in large part, people have learned the wrong lesson from the past 30 years, which is that debt does not matter, or at least public debt does not matter. And I think there's a couple things that kind of gave us that false belief. And so when you go back in history, debt in the US and large other portions of the Western world, but focusing on the US with these charts, debt as a percentage of GDP on the public level was very low. And that was in large part because you had, you know, long period of inflation, you had rising rates for a long period of time. But then we entered this 40-year period of steadily declining interest rates, and that allowed more and more debt accumulation. And if you are constantly accumulating debts, but you're also constantly reducing your interest rate, your interest expense is very manageable. And if you look at the late 80s, that was a time period where interest rates were still high, and debts and deficits were rising very quickly. And that was kind of the peak alarm or the peak zeitgeist of public debts. And so, for example, the famous debt clock was put in place in the late 80s. Ross Perot ran the most successful independent presidential campaign based largely on fighting the debts and deficits in the early 90s. And that was kind of the peak moment. And if you look at those charts, that was also basically the peak moment for interest expense as a percentage of GDP. What some of those people didn't expect, and you know, you can argue could not have expected, is that there'd be an unprecedented period of disinflation and falling interest rates for the next three decades. And that was in large part tied to, you know, the opening of China in the 80s and 90s, which really ramped up in the 2000s, the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, and then the opening up of Russia, including gas to Europe. So we had all these disinflationary pressures. We basically brought Western capital together with Eastern labor and resources, and that brought a lot of order to the world. It brought a lot of globalization, disinflation, that allowed interest rates to go steadily down, that allowed more financialization, more debt accumulation. And it really kind of pushed back the timeline that those people were concerned about by about 30 years. But of course, the problem is when you eventually run into zero interest rates, and then you turn to large and larger fiscal, and you get kind of a sideways to up structure in interest rates, you stop having that offset from that rising debt and deficits. And so suddenly interest expense starts to matter again. Suddenly the sheer amount of fiscal driven money supply and treasury issuance starts to matter again. And then these things tend to feed on themselves. So crises, you know, geopolitically can lead to sovereign debt crises. And at the same time, sovereign debt crises can lead to geopolitical crises because people can see that, you know, you're more financially vulnerable, that you're more focused domestically, and then they can do things to kind of address or take back some of what they perceive as their share. And so I think we've transitioned away from this like 30 years of ever greater global integration and disinflation and falling interest rates. And now, you know, we're entering a period where I think the debts are going to start mattering again. I think we've already seen that playing out. And I think that's going to be a longer term cyclical trend that kind of comes and goes going forward. And a lot of people, I think, have been lulled into complacency over the past 30 years about the idea that public debts in the West don't really matter.
Let's talk about the end game for that. I agree with you that people have been lulled into believing, hey, deficits don't matter. We had that whole debate back in the 90s and it blew over. Everybody forgot about it. Deficits don't matter. Just keep spending. Don't worry about it. When does that actually meet its day of reckoning? What's the mechanism that causes that to all come crashing down?
I think the challenge is when central banks find themselves in a position where inflation is above target, but they still have to buy sovereign debt. That's really kind of the checkmate. Right now, Japan's in that situation, but they also have decades of accumulated positive net international investment position. They have extremely high social harmony, and they have a lot of control over their markets. They're balanced trade situation. And a lot of their monetization has happened over the past decade. Like if you look at their central bank balance sheet, it really started ramping up in late 2012, so a little over 10 years now. And that coincided with the commodity bear market. So if you have a commodity bear market and you have a current account surplus and you have generally benign global conditions, deficit monetization isn't the end of the world necessarily. But when you start getting a commodity bull market due to a CapEx cycle having concluded, and if you're a different country that's running a structural trade deficit to begin with, then that combination can get more toxic, I think. So I think, again, people have a benign understanding of the idea that we're all just going to be Japan eventually. And I think that the reality is likely to be more volatile, messier, and probably on average more inflationary than the story of Japan has taught us over the past decade.
On page 2, you're showing the 102-year chart of the capitalization cycle. What's the story here?
So this is a chart I've shown a number of times. I've updated it over time. And it basically just shows, I've made a lot of times the comparison that the 2020s are like the 1940s. And this is the primary chart that I used to show it. That basically, when you have falling interest rates, rising debts in the private sector, eventually you hit zero and you get a massive bank recapitalization. Now, that is historically not inflationary, but it's the second phase is when you're risk inflation. Basically, you've pushed debt from the private sector to the public sector. You've gone through a period of economic stagnation, usually associated with a period of rising populism. And then that's when you're more vulnerable to public debt, sovereign debt, currency type of crises, or at least inflation. And some of that populism starts to kind of unfold in various ways. And so we had kind of a 1-2 punch in both the 1930s and the 1940s, and then again in the 2010s and the 2020s, which is first you have the popping of a private debt bubble, which was the 1929 crash, and then again was the 2008 crash. Then you have bank recapitalizations. It's a disinflationary period, more and more debts up to the public level. And then where it starts to get the kind of the next era is when you have very high public debts and you're no longer in a position where interest rates are as effective of a tool of managing that. Because if you raise interest rates while public sector debt is low, then it has the desired effects of pushing down the private sector, slowing inflation, slowing economic activity, and it doesn't really result in much larger deficits. But if you do that same thing while you already have 120% debt to GDP or more, then as you raise interest rates, you do push the same downward pressure on the private sector, but you also spill out a lot more money into the private sector through larger deficits that are largely because of that interest expense. And so basically, we shift from a period of monetary dominance to fiscal dominance. And I think that's the era we're in now. And that's why I think that some of these technologies we just talked about are important, even for developed markets, because the normal tool set to deal with very high sovereign debt levels is financial repression. They basically try to corral more and more capital to kind of stay where it is, get into treasuries, even when those treasuries are performing very poorly, and they're generally trying to kind of run the inflation playbook. And so, but in the era of social media, and in the era of, being able to memorize 12 words and bring unlimited amounts of value across borders, that's just a much harder environment to do things like that than they did. The developed world did it back in the 1940s and thereafter, and the developing world does it all the time now. And these technologies just make that much harder to repeat these playbooks.
Page 3, you're talking about the net international investment position. What do you mean by that phrase, and what is the chart telling us?
So what that is a measure of how much foreign assets are owned by a country and its citizens versus how much of that country's assets are owned by other countries and their citizens, whether at the sovereign wealth fund level or just at the household level, corporate level. And, a country like Japan has a very positive net international investment position. They take years of trade surpluses, current account surpluses, they invest them overseas in a variety of different assets. It could be owning U.S. stocks. It could be owning U.S. bonds. It could be owning European assets. It could be owning copper mines in, random country. They basically own all these foreign assets. And when they have crises, they have the option to kind of repatriate capital, pull it back. Whereas the U.S. has been on the other side of this arrangement, where we have a deeper and deeper negative net international investment position. And that has been structurally tied to our currency system. A fellow analyst, Luke Grohman, covers this quite a bit, that basically a key kind of cost for having the global reserve currency is that if everybody needs your currency, you have to supply the world with your currency. And the way that the market makes that happen is through, at least in the current era, is through the trade deficit. So, for example, there's so much extra demand for the dollar that boosts the value of it. And then that, you know, makes it so that Americans have a lot more import power than they otherwise would, but some of their lower margin exports are a lot less competitive than they otherwise would be. So they're kind of more restricted to like intellectual property type of work. And so basically part of our export is dollars, and that kind of takes away from some of our other exports. And so we have this kind of increasing situation where every one of these cycles that goes by, the foreign sector accumulates more and more, a larger and larger percentage of U.S. financial assets. And that's what results in some of these instabilities. That's why we have things like swap lines. That's why we have kind of a, you know, kind of disturbing sell-offs when there's volatility events, is that although the foreign sector needs a lot of dollars, they increasingly have a lot of assets to sell to get dollars. And it's basically, along with the debt levels, it's another kind of sign that this existing system, as it's been in place for a number of decades, is just basically every year that goes by, the instability keeps increasing.
Finally, page 4, you've got what you're calling the world's most important chart. I certainly relate to that. It's the Our World in Data, Global Primary Energy Consumption by Source chart, which was also the star of my Energy Transition Crisis documentary series. Tell me why you think this is the world's most important chart. I certainly agree with you, but let's get your perspective on why this matters so much.
Well, I think one of the only things that can compete with broken money as things that you don't want to break is broken energy. Probably the most important thing you don't want to have go bad is your access to energy. Our current population is based on the amount of energy we have. The standard of living is based on the amount of energy we have. And this chart shows the rapid increase in energy over the past century that the world has enjoyed. And it's mostly increasingly gone towards more and more dense energy sources. So we went from traditional biomass to coal to oil to natural gas to nuclear and hydro. Those are all quite, you know, increasingly dense energy sources. And they make up the vast majority of the energy we produce. And the challenge going forward is that this is a hard trajectory to maintain, to say the least. And that's what you get, all sorts of political and geopolitical challenges with it. You get environmental concerns. You get concerns about whether or not some of these energy sources are going to be able to keep growing at the rate they have been, even putting aside any environmental impacts. And then you have confusion or conflicts around some of the technologies that are able to likely keep growing our energy usage, and whether or not they should be allowed to keep growing. And that's also why I think that your docuseries, The Energy Transition Crisis, was super important, because, you know, other than kind of drawing people's attention to how the monetary system works, I think one of the biggest things over this next decade is drawing people's attention to how energy works and what's at stake with our energy.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I think it's going to be a very interesting ride. One of the things that concerns me the most is how politicized this is and how the political process actually detracts from people's understanding of the core underlying issues. Let's talk about energy in the context of current political events, Lynn. The Market Ear put up a really interesting post earlier this week where they just showed past geopolitical events and the rally in crude oil. So the 1973 oil embargo, I think this is a very different time than 1973, and I don't think it's valid to try to say that this is equivalent. But look, that was a 279% increase in the price of oil over the course of 17 weeks. The Iranian Revolution, 42% in 22 weeks. The Gulf War, 93% up on oil in 10 weeks. The Iraq War, 50% up on oil in 16 weeks. The Ukraine War, 38% increase in the price of oil over the course of 3 weeks. Now we've got the Israel-Hamas War, as it's being called. And we've got only a 4% increase in the price of oil. Now, a lot of people would say, well, that's because Israel and Gaza are both places where there's no significant oil production, so it doesn't matter. I would argue the exact opposite. I would say that the potential of this conflict to grow into a regional conflict that lasts for many years and affects oil producers across the entire region of the Middle East is very high. And it seems like very few people are realizing that. I feel like I've got one of the highest variant perception moments of my career here. Second only to the pandemic in January of 2020 when I started shorting crude oil futures. I'm going the other direction now because it seems to me like the market is badly underpricing the risk of what could go wrong here. How do you see this? Am I missing something or are we underpricing the risk of what could happen next?
So I agree with you, and I separate this into two layers, which was before these events unfolded, I've already had a structurally bullish view on, you know, most types of energy producers, including oil, and that's largely just due to the CapEx cycle. Basically, that there's been a period of underdevelopment. Most of the growth has been from U.S. shale, which is, you know, basically has trouble growing at the same rate that it has been going forward. And, you know, when you add geopolitical conflicts into it, the upside only gets more significant. So even before this, the first layer is just purely the CapEx cycle. And when you have an already tight energy market, any marginal supply that either goes offline or gets blocked from certain areas or just more frictions are added to how that supply gets to where it needs to be can only make the problem worse. And so I have no particular insight on the probability of oil being disrupted in, say, the next 6 months, 12 months. I would leave that to geopolitical experts. Basically, you know, when I look at, say, oil producers, I consider them kind of positive carry, you know, just options long term on there being another energy bull market within the next several years because they're profitable. Many of them have good balance sheets. They pay dividends. And should we get significant, you know, longer term oil appreciation, they're well positioned. And of course, you can also play it with the commodity directly. You can play it with drilling or support services companies. There's multiple ways to play it, but I think that basically the world is due for another CapEx cycle that only happens with higher prices. And those can come sooner or later, depending on geopolitical outcomes. And another thing worth mentioning is that we look back, you know, almost exactly 50 years ago, The high energy prices in the United States had two significant components to them. One is that if you look at, you know, prior to that point, U.S. was a huge producer of energy. I mean, they've reclaimed that in recent years. But if you look at a chart from, say, the 1870s up to the 1970s, oil production in the U.S. increased almost every year. It was a structurally upward trend of more and more conventional oil production. And that peaked in 1970. And it started to roll over structurally for decades. And so the U.S. became increasingly reliant imports. And even putting that aside, just the world lost its basically, you know, primary grower of oil production during that era. And so that's where the Middle East became a very large dominant producer because the U.S. was no longer able to keep growing supply until, of course, we go forward decades and get to the shale changes. But during that multi-decade window, and especially early on in that window, there was a lot of leverage given to the Middle East, and they were able to push that. And so really it comes down to two things going together. One is that the existing supply can no longer grow at the rate that it has been, and those that either can do supply or have power over supply realize that fact. And so I would say we're in a somewhat similar position now in the sense that, you know, I think that U.S. shale can grow more, but I think it grows at a more decelerated rate at best, and that the marginal source of new oil has to come from elsewhere, especially at the scale that the world's likely going to need it. And just that the supply situation is very tight globally. And I think that's just an area that is not getting enough attention. I think that, you know, there's so much focus on the 60-40 portfolio, but both stocks and bonds prefer disinflation. Overall, they prefer kind of order. They prefer low commodity prices. And if someone wants to protect their other holdings, whether it's their equities, whether it's their cash, I think you have to be aware of how significant a spike of energy would likely harm your other investments. And so I think that that's just it's an underallocated area for most investors' portfolio.
Lynn, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, tell us a little bit more about Lynn Alden Investment Strategy and what you do there.
So I provide research for retail and institutional investors on what's happening in macro markets, as well as, you know, kind of specific industries or investments. And you know, I also cover the stuff we covered here, basically what's happening in the world of Bitcoin, what's happening in the world of stablecoins, anything that might be relevant to, I think I would describe it as more serious pools of capital. So like, I'm not particularly interested in the crypto frauds and things that are happening, but any sort of innovations that are happening that I think are relevant on a macro scale. And I'm also, I work with Ego Death Capital that does some venture work in that space. So it kind of this covering everything related to money, energy, and macro is stuff I like to focus on across my platforms.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com. Energy Transition Crisis, my new video documentary series about energy transition, has finally been released, and anyone can watch it for free at energytransitioncrisis.org. The series explains exactly what it's really going to take to break humanity's addiction to fossil fuels and why it will take longer and cost more than almost anyone realizes. And I'd like to think the three episodes on nuclear energy are among the most detailed on YouTube. This is a passion project for me, and there's no profit motive, no revenue, and therefore no budget other than donations. I'd really appreciate your help promoting the series. Things you can do to help include subscribing to the Energy Crisis Doc YouTube channel, liking every episode, posting comments on YouTube, and posting links to your favorite episodes on social media. If you don't have time to do those things, there's also a donations page at energytransitioncrisis.org. The money does not go to me. 100% of it will be spent on YouTube and other social media advertising to promote the series. Thanks in advance for your help. Now let's get back to the show and Patrick's post-game chart deck.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, great to have Lynn back on the show. Joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Also, we will shortly be joined by Anas Alhaji for an update on the crude oil markets. Now let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Lynn's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's get to crude oil, starting with the EIA inventory.
EIA printed a drawdown of 4.5 million barrels. That's reversing the trend of builds for the last couple of weeks. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down another 758,000 barrels, taking us really back down to about 20 million barrels. That's the virtual tank bottom level in Cushing, Oklahoma. Of course, 20 million barrels is not an insignificant amount of oil, but they need a certain amount of oil in order to be able to support their blending operations and so forth. They're really at a functional minimum right now. So we have a crisis situation there that's really important to keep an eye on. More importantly, the drawdowns are spreading back into finished products. Gasoline drawing down 2.4 million barrels, distillates drawing down 3.2 million barrels. U.S. production is holding unchanged this week at 13.2 million barrels, but last week when we weren't able to report due to the holiday, we had a really big jump up to 13.2. So we're now at a new all-time high in U.S. production. A very important question to ask is how long can that last? We're working on getting some guests lined up in coming weeks to talk about that subject. I said last week that this is a major variant perception moment for me. I think the risk to the already vulnerable oil market from a further escalation of the Israel-Gaza conflict is extremely high. To my own surprise, though, our very well-respected colleague, Dr. Anas Alhaji, has a much more moderate view of the extent of that risk. So to balance my own admittedly strong views, I'm going to invite Anas on in just a couple of minutes to give us a quick update. But let me first start by explaining my own views on this developing systemic systemic risk to the oil markets. First of all, Macro Voices will take no sides in this conflict between Israel and Hamas. As financial journalists, our job is to report objectively on what geopolitical developments are likely to mean to financial markets, not to opine on the merits of the events themselves. So my view begins with understanding that the global oil market is already very fragile. With the exception of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, OPEC is already producing at capacity. Everyone is assuming that rational expectations theory is going to continue to apply. In other words, any country that's got oil and is in the business of producing oil is going to sell their oil at the highest price they possibly can because that's what's in their economic best interest. And everyone assumes that they will just continue doing that indefinitely. I think that's the dangerous assumption. The Russia-Ukraine war already poses the risk of the stakes rising to levels where I think there's a chance that Russia could take an economically irrational action, such as not selling all of the oil that it's producing, in order to prosecute a political agenda, such as cutting oil production for the intentional purpose of weaponizing oil prices. Even though that doesn't seem to be in Russia's economic interest, it may be that they put higher priority on their political agenda than their economic agenda. Now we have this Israel-Arab relations situation blowing up in a way that's not going to blow over anytime soon. Again, we're not taking any sides on who's right or wrong in this conflict. My point is simply that an escalation has occurred that cannot possibly be undone. The atrocities on both sides, the extent of just how much violence has occurred in the last few weeks, cannot be undone or forgotten. So there's going to be a long-standing rise in geopolitical tensions in this area. Now, there's no significant oil production in Israel or Gaza, so there's no direct risk here. The risk is from a broader regional conflict developing to the point where some of the oil-producing nations begin to make economically irrational decisions in support of a political agenda. Now, they don't have the option of increasing their oil production in reaction to any geopolitical situation because most of them are already producing as much as they can. The question is, are there scenarios where we might be assuming they're going to continue to sell all of their oil and they don't do so? I think that's a very high risk, but Dr. Anas Al-Haji, who's very, very knowledgeable on this subject, actually has a more modest view. So let's bring in Dr. Anas Al-Haji now. Anas, some people are saying it's 1973 all over again, oil embargo, we're going to see tripling of oil prices. Other people say, no, look, there's no significant oil production in Israel or Gaza. This is irrelevant to oil and gas markets. I got to believe it's somewhere in between. Which is it? And also, is it just about oil or is gas a different story than oil?
I think you summarized it very well here. We have to remember the following. There were three embargoes historically. The first one was in 1956. That was imposed by Saudi Arabia on the UK and France when they attacked Egypt after Egypt nationalized the Suez Canal. And then we have the embargo of 1967, that's during the war. And then that was several countries, not only Saudi Arabia, about seven Arab countries imposed the embargo. Both of them failed and failed miserably. And the first one was symbolic. The second one, they tried to do something, but it did not work. And then in 1973, we had an issue here because on the 17th of October, yesterday was the 50th anniversary of that, the ministers recommended an embargo. On the 18th, we had two countries that imposed the embargo. Then on the 19th, Saudi Arabia joined them and the announcement was official of imposing an embargo that was associated with a production cut to make the embargo more effective. And the embargo was on three countries, the United States, Denmark, and the Netherlands. And what we see here is this was a total failure. And this fits with the literature. We have a literature of 120 years that covered all kinds of sanctions from all countries. We have hundreds and hundreds of events, and each one of them failed. And the embargo fits with that. It did not work. Why it did not work? Because the first thing is, what was the objective of the embargo? The objective of the embargo was to force Israel to the borders of 1967, or what they call the UN Resolution 242, and stop the Western support for Israel. That was in 1973. Now, look at now. Israel expanded, and the support is stronger than ever. And we have President Biden today there. So it failed miserably because the declared objectives of the embargo were not achieved. And when we say declared, because there could be some other unknown objectives, and I'm going to allude to that in a minute, of the embargo. And if the unclear, undeclared objectives basically are correct, then those countries achieve their objective. But the two declared objectives of returning Israel to 1967 borders and to stop the Western support to Israel, both of them were not achieved. The embargo lasted for about 2 months. The actual embargo lasted for about 2 months, but the official embargo ended 4 months later. What's strange about that is this. People think that this was an OPEC embargo. It wasn't an OPEC embargo. It was several Arab countries who did this. OPEC has Arab countries, non-Arab countries, including Iran and Venezuela, Indonesia, and others. So it wasn't OPEC. Was it AWAPEC, that the Arab oil-producing countries? No, it wasn't, because there were other Arab members did not participate in the embargo. But the issue here is this, that they say that oil prices quadrupled because of the embargo. That is another mistake. They did not quadruple because of the embargo, because 2 days earlier, before the embargo, OPEC met and increased posted prices by 70%. Posted prices are the prices that are used at that time to calculate taxes, because there was no price of oil in the market at that time. No one knew what the price of oil in the market, because the companies, the oil majors, were vertically integrated. They sold within the company itself. So the producer sold to the refiner and the refiner sold to the distributor, but all of them are the same company. So we have some sort of transfer pricing, but no one knew what the price is. So they have to come up with something to measure taxes. So they came up with the posted prices. So by increasing the prices by 70% unilaterally, they forced the companies basically, or they increased the cost of the companies significantly. And the companies, since they are integrated, they had to pass it to the consumer. So prices went up because of that. So we cannot say that the embargo increased prices by fourfold. The embargo itself was, again, based on the declared objectives, was a complete failure. However, there is, and I'm speaking academically here, studies that have been done on this concluded the following. The embargo achieved its objectives. And what were the objectives? Arab nationalism at that time was very strong. Communists in the Arab world were kind of really strong, and some of them basically in power. And many people, even in the Gulf countries, were either Arab nationalists or communists. And that was a threat to the existing governments that were supporters of the United States. And the idea here is, if it wasn't for the embargo, the Soviet Union would have controlled the area. And we would not have seen the oil flow for the last 50 years coming from the Middle East to the United States and Europe. So they had the embargo literally to pull the rug from beneath the communist and Arab nationalists. So you don't see the Arabs led by Cairo or Damascus or Baghdad. Now it is led by Riyadh, Kuwait, and Abu Dhabi. So if that's the objective, it was achieved. So this is the undeclared objective in this case. But it was a total failure. Why? Because the suffering of those countries in the 80s when the market collapsed was massive. Massive to the extent that those governments almost went bankrupt. And everything in those economies just stalled, completely stalled. There was no money. Imagine that in 1985 and 86, Saudis had to cut production from 10 million barrels a day to 2. So the cut alone was more than the exports of Saudi Arabia today. The cut was 8 million barrels a day, yet oil prices continued to decline. As if this is not enough. We lost the Iraqi oil. We lost the Iranian oil. So we lost this 8 million from Saudi Arabia, and we lost about 5 million from Iraq and Iran, and yet prices continue to decline. Why? Because high prices in the 70s after the embargo led to the building of the Alaska pipeline. That's 2.5 million barrels a day. Then the North Sea came in online. That's 3 million barrels a day. Then we found oil in more than 15 countries. They did not discover oil before. So we had more oil than ever. At the same time, look what we did in the United States. We helped establish the International Energy Agency, which is a headache for OPEC and Saudi Arabia right now. They started the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is a big headache for OPEC. They established the Department of Energy, which is spending billions of dollars on renewable energy, EVs and batteries and everything else. And we had the speed limit that increased the efficiency. We had the CAFE standards that enhanced and improved the efficiency of engines and reduced gasoline consumption big time. We have all those efforts between Europe, the United States, Japan, and others that reduced the demand significantly. So we ended up with lower demand and massive increase in supply and nothing. The efforts of Saudi Arabia and the loss of Iraqis and Iranian oil did not even help improve prices. And those countries suffered for more than a decade. So the idea here is they paid the price heavily for it. They learned from it. They know that oil cannot be used as a weapon. They have three experiences. It failed every time. They lost market share. It takes between 8 years to 15 years to recover market share. So the bottom line here is do not expect the oil weapon to be used again.
Anas, I want to fast forward to today based on what you just said. You're saying it sounds like governments are not likely to invoke this oil weapon because it hasn't really worked effectively in the past. But in terms of public sentiment, a whole bunch of very strong public anger is being developed on both sides of this conflict. And in the Muslim world and the Arab world, certainly the politics it's leading to riots and so forth all over the place. If there are not likely to be governments weaponizing oil or the oil price tool the way you're saying, what about terrorist organizations and others that might be reacting to just the public sentiment that's now occurring?
I think probably if you look at oil prices and the increase that we've seen, which is about almost $7 now, what we call the political premium, is really because of that. Forget about the Iranian statements about the use of the weapon, because the Iranians been saying this for 40 years. In fact, today on my Twitter feed, I posted a statement by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, who said something like this exactly after the Israeli army basically went to Gaza and killed a lot of people. And he said, oh, we need to impose an oil embargo. And you can see it. You can read it. It is on my Twitter feed. So these are all things. But the fear, this is real. That individuals or organizations can wreak havoc on the oil industry. Why? Because the technology improved substantially in recent years, that with like a few hundred dollars, you can literally cause problems to a major oil tanker or a major oil facility. Drone for $200-$300 basically can help do that. So the improvement in technology enabled individuals and small groups to cause major damage. And this is a real possibility because people are looking at their governments and they think that their governments are not doing enough. And therefore, they are angry at their governments as much as they are angry at the Israelis. So this is a real threat.
Anas, final question. Let's talk about gas versus oil. Is it the same story or are they different and why are they different?
This is a completely different story. And the reason why, because Israel has three gas fields and Israel exports natural gas to Egypt and Jordan. And Tamar field, you can see the Tamar field from the Gaza beaches. It's too close to Gaza. So they closed it. And closing Tamar basically means reduction of gas to Egypt, reduction of gas to Jordan, and not enough gas within Israel. And that is a problem because the other two fields cannot compensate for Tamar. And therefore, Egypt cannot re-export the gas in the form of LNG to Europe. So the impact is on Europe. And the Jordanians are going to have a major energy crisis because of that, and they have to resort to LNG. As for the Israelis, and this sounds like really strange, the only way for the Israelis basically to compensate is to import more coal. And that's a problem because the Israeli left and the Israeli climate activists are going to go crazy when their country is going to import more coal to burn in power plants. So we'll see how they are going to justify that. But the main outcome of all of this is this conflict, the final nail in the coffin of any gas pipeline from the Eastern Mediterranean to Europe. What we are seeing right now, the options for Europe to substitute Russian gas are dwindling. And the only two options left are the United States and Qatar. And therefore, we believe that Russian gas will continue to flow to Europe for a very long time.
Anas, I can't thank you enough for joining us for this update. Before I let you go, just tell our listeners where they can find your Twitter feed and your Substack if they want to follow your analysis in more depth.
Sure. Everything we talked about today and others, basically, we already published reports on that. And we have it on Substack. They can go to my Twitter account, Anas Alhaji, A-N-A-S-A-L-H-A-J-J-I, and they can get all the information from my bio there or my tweets. So all the information is there.
Thanks so much for joining us, Anas. We look forward to getting you back for a feature interview as our schedule permits. Let's continue with our post-game segment now.
Well, Eric, on page 2, I have a crude oil chart, and I just wanted to highlight how we are now on the December contract trading already back toward its highs. Obviously, the front month contracts back then were at higher levels, but generally, we have an oil market that is poised for a bull breakout. Now, we haven't yet broken those 90 levels, which I think are going to be critical for really building a new trend, but if we see a proper breakout here, that could really set in motion a bull continuation pattern. I'm watching the 88 and 90 levels on the short term, just as levels where I think a continuation pattern can really emerge. Nick, I want to get you in the conversation. Let's talk some of these equity levels. I want to give my observation on the S&P in a moment, but I want to start off with just what are the technical levels in the option market implied suggesting here on the S&P?
So, Patrick, spot price right now is 43.15 on SPX. We have a call wall above at 4,400 and a put wall below at 4,300. The implied move for the November 17th monthly OPEX is plus minus 165 points. So the upper potential move would be 44.80 and the lower potential move would be 41.50. The key resistance area right now is above at 4,400 and just below at 4,300 and 4,250 are the key support areas. Again, as I mentioned last week, I'm inclined to think we see a big move out of this range after the VIX-spiration yesterday. I think we either break to the upside perhaps a little bit to 44.50 perhaps, but I'm more inclined to think that we test out that 4,200 level prior to perhaps some stability before maybe making a bounce back to this area again. But we've been bouncing in this range between 4,300 and 4,400 for the past couple of weeks, and I think that's going to conclude in the next couple of days.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. Like, obviously, we had the big OPEX week, which causes gamma pinning and trade ranges with huge put and call walls between 4,400 and 4,300 on the S&P, like you were suggesting. And that certainly has pinned the market. We have the big gamma roll-off coming on Friday as the index options all roll off. So I think volatility returning into next week is very likely. Sure, a quick little pop up to 44.50 is certainly something within reason in terms of just markets whipping higher and lower. But I just, when I look at the broader intermarkets and the way yields are breaking and the way a lot of other markets are behaving, the way the breadth of the market continues to deteriorate, it to me looks rather bearish. And the 4,300 level, I think, is actually very important because the way I look at it is any price action that starts breaking below 4,300 is marking some sort of a distribution cycle that would line up with a Russell 2000 that is breaking to a fresh low that would start to see deterioration in other markets, including the NASDAQ giving out 15,000. All of these things can really start to come together and open the floodgate for another leg down. And I know the implied range was down to 4,150 that you were saying, but I think we could make it down to even 4,100 with some accelerated selling next week. The big thing for me is watching the 4,300 pivot and whether it gives out. Now let's move on to the NASDAQ. What are the levels you watching here?
Spot price in the queues right now is approximately 363. We have a call wall above at 380 and a put wall below at 345. The implied move for the November 17th OPEX is plus minus 19 points. So the upper potential move would be 382 and the lower potential move would be 344 approximately. We have key resistance above at 370 and 375 and key support below at 360 and 355. Given that we're entering earnings season right now, a lot of these moves will be dictated by what happens with earning reports. We had Netflix beat last night, Tesla missed handedly, and you know they're respectively right now. Netflix is up a lot, and Tesla's down about 7% or so. So right now, we need to wait for the next couple of weeks to see what happens. But if earnings are poor from the big guys like Apple, Google, Meta, Amazon, Microsoft, that will bode for a lower move, obviously. And if they're strong, it may move higher, right? But in the short term, I do think that we may top out somewhere around 370, 375, and then make a lower low around 335, 340 or so.
You know what? I completely agree with almost everything you said. The first observations to make is that the breadth of the entire market, including NASDAQ Composite, have actually been awful. And it's really been these Magnificent Seven stocks that have kept the indices higher just because they're such a huge behemoths from a market cap perspective that they're holding everything higher. And really, I mean, outside right now, only Google and Meta are stocks that are actually pressing highs and holding this trend in place. And so we're seeing more and more of the generals being shot. I mean, the way that we see the, obviously, Tesla weak here, but also you take a look at the way that NVIDIA has rolled over is that a head and shoulders pattern topping formation that's developing there. If we see the earnings in any way start cracking the Magnificent Seven, that really could be a driver that causes index selling in a broader way. And so that's why I think next week is going to be so critical. And so I agree with you on your assessment there quite a bit. Touching, though, on page six, we have the volatility index, and we're still in the teens. You know, I would think that at this stage, with the way that things are, the volatility premiums on market insurance would have been heightened already, at least into the mid-20s. Now, at this stage, with us trading down here, I still think you can go long volatility, even though there's always the vulnerability of us returning back to the summer lows. But like realistically here in mid-October where volatility reigns, the idea that we're going to see the VIX on a 13 handle again just doesn't seem like a probable call. Anyway, how do you view the VIX here?
So right now with the VIX at around 19 change, we expect to see about 1.25% broad market moves per day. And right now, what I'm looking at is a possible break above 20 and a hold above 20, which would then precipitate a possible pop to 25 to 30. And that would probably require some exogenous event to pop it that high. But right now, if you're watching the intraday ranges on SPX, for instance, we're seeing a lot of whipsaw action where we push in one direction for maybe half the day. And in the last couple of hours, we revert back to the mean again. So you know, these moves aren't outlandish, like the 1.25% moves. We're not seeing a lot of those moves each day in terms of like the finishing price from the opening price, but what we're seeing is a lot of whipsaw action intraday. So it's kind of hard to read the price action overall using the VIX because, again, predicated upon the average 30-day expiration on SPX. And right now we have over 50% of the option trading volume is on zero DTE. So a lot more weight is put on the zero DTE options. So following that kind of flow is more important. And what I'm seeing is that if we if we stay in this little range right now between, you know, 18 and 20, it's more probable we're going to see a pop higher. And that could probably be spurred on by perhaps some premium selling on the put side, where we get below a certain floor level, like 4,200, for example, and then we just keep rolling down because so many people are underwater on their short puts. Now, moving on to page 7, we have the US dollar index. What are your thoughts here?
The Dixie peaked out at 107, and it's now consolidating in a range between 105 and 107. So the question obviously becomes, okay, is this consolidation that's occurring between 105 and 107 a continuation pattern that's, you know, winding up for maybe another move higher? Or is it a reversal pattern that's maybe setting up for a move to the downside? Well, it seems to me that probably the reason we're consolidating here is the market's waiting for some kind of indication as to whether there's going to be further geopolitical escalation. And if there is, it seems to me that a continuation of further dollar strength in the face of increasing global geopolitical tension makes perfect sense. So I'm bracing myself for a move higher on the dollar, but I think it's going to take a geopolitical catalyst in order to bring that move about.
You know, Eric, while you're identifying that trade range, I actually think that there's a real good chance that the U.S. dollar is going to continue higher. And that in itself would be bearish for most risk assets. When you look here, the dollar has been consolidating in that range you're highlighting. But that 107 level is going to be critical, because any breakout of the dollar above 107 it could set in motion a dollar upside acceleration. And when you really break it down on the individual majors and how they're all trading, the Euro USD, incredibly weak chart, the pound against the US dollar, incredibly weak chart, the US dollar yen trading up along the 150 level like it's ready to break out. You look at the US dollar against the renminbi up along its highs, ready to break out. The US dollar against the CAD up along its highs, ready to break out. There is literally no chart that is diverging from this, and there doesn't seem to be a catalyst that is imminent that it could change this dollar trend. On balance, I actually think there's a good chance here the dollar's about to rip, and that could end up being a very big contributor to broader weakness in risk assets. So this is, I think, a critical chart to watch. It's one of the things I think is going to dictate a lot of the other trends as we move forward.
And moving on to page 8, we have the gold futures chart. Eric, what are your thoughts here?
Well, the chart looks terrific, and in many ways, it feels like this market wants to discount the idea that rates have already peaked and nothing can go wrong for gold. I'm not so sure about rates peaking or nothing can go wrong, but unfortunately, I do think the geopolitical tension that's helping to put a bid under gold is likely to continue. So, to my thinking, there is a setup here that maybe this is the beginning of the really big move up for gold, but we would need some confirmation that we really have reached a peak in interest rates. And I'm not at all convinced that that's true. So I think that we're probably going to see further strength in gold. At some point, I think there's going to be a hiccup when we realize that maybe the last round is not in yet for higher interest rates as the Fed continues to fight inflation.
You know, Eric, I look at what happened in the last week on gold to be actually a game changer. I mean, we've been in a 6-month consolidation in gold, and it's been one thing that we just had to say, well, listen, this simply isn't the time when gold is ready to go. But you have a scenario where the U.S. dollar remains very strong, a typical period where gold should be under pressure, and yet geopolitics have created this extraordinary reversal, bringing us right back to the summer highs on gold. And to me, at this stage, this is the first bullish price action we've seen since the that November to March rally at the end of last year, going into the first quarter of this year. And if we see gold able to hold above 1900 on a sustained basis and above its 200-day moving average moving forward, we'll ask a very important question as to whether gold is diverging from its natural intermarket relationship and trends, and actually geopolitics driving a new accumulation cycle. It is very early or premature to already get super bullish gold, but this is the most bullish price action that we have seen on bullion in a half a year. And so I'm paying attention. I think it's going to be really interesting to see whether this develops into something bigger. I wanted to, on page 9, though, talk talk about the U.S. Government bond on the 10-year yield. And we have just seen an outright acceleration in yields rising. And this, it's not even like the bond sell-off is actually losing momentum. And this, to me, is another big red flag. Typically, for the last 30 years, bonds have acted as a safe haven asset during periods where equities are under pressure. And yet we have the exact opposite, where actually the bond bear market is now actually grabbing the equity markets by the ankles and dragging them down. And the big question here is are we about to see a crack of 5%? Because that could be one of these things that drives a little bit of a shockwave through the markets. And that could be what spurs some volatility in everything next week. I think watching the yields here is critical. The final thing I wanted to touch on page 10 is the Uranium Trust. This is the Sprott Physical Trust. And uranium has been in a multi-week consolidation after an extraordinary breakout. But this is one of the few places that remains in a very clean bull trend. And after this kind of a consolidation, the big question here is, are we about to see another bull breakout in uranium? It's a very bullish chart, and I'll be watching, at least on this Sprott Physical as it's priced on the TSX, a breakout above $23 to see whether or not it is spurring on a new advance. We obviously have the U308 already trading back above 70, so it'll be interesting to see whether uranium starts a new bull trend.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to the Amazon page to buy Broken Money, Lynn Alden's new book. You're also going to find Lynn's slide deck and the chart book we discussed in the postgame, including a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.